This webcast is made possible in part by support from the listener members of the Classical Network, WWFM and WWFM.org. Thank you for your support. Cadenza, winner of the Deems Taylor Virgil Thompson Award for Broadcasting, is a production of the Classical Network. Funding for this program is made possible by the listener members of the Classical Network. I'm David Ozenberg, your host. Back in May, I ran a series of programs featuring and chatting with great maestros not born here but leading major U.S. orchestras in Cincinnati, Minnesota, Nashville, and Washington, D.C. My guest today, the Frenchman Ludovic Morlot, should be included in that group, and since 2010, he has been music director of the Seattle Symphony. He began as a violinist. His skills and strengths were noticed, and he was invited to try out the podium. After studies in England, he came here, attending the Piedmontau School for Conductors and held the Seiji Ozawa Fellowship in Conducting at the Tanglewood Festival back in 2001. He became assistant conductor with the Boston Symphony Orchestra under James Levine, also served as conductor-in-residence with the Orchestre National de Lyon under American David Robertson. When the Seattle Symphony came to him to replace the long-tenured directorship of Gerard Schwartz, it would be my guest's first full directorship of a major orchestra. Concurrently, he held the directorship of one of Europe's great opera houses, La Monnaie, in Brussels. He also accepted teaching positions at the University of Washington and became entrenched in that great Pacific Northwest city. He made bold moves, trying out different ways and structures of concerts to draw in new audiences and fresh ears, growing the audience average by a hefty percentage. He and his symphony began a record label, Seattle Symphony Media, and won two Grammys, one for a composer he introduced to Seattle, the Frenchman Henri Dutilleux, and the quintessential American music of Charles Ives. He also commissioned and recorded a work by American composer John Luther Adams that would go on to win the Pulitzer Prize. All was going swimmingly. His contract extended through 2019, and then just a few months ago, he announced that he would, after that year, leave Seattle and move on to new challenges and horizons, not being specific as to what they were. All the recordings you'll hear in this program, save one, will be on that Seattle Symphony Media label, such as what you're listening to now from a disc with Stravinsky's Petrushka. You're listening to the final minutes of the second movement of another ballet, Claude Debussy's late work known as The Toy Box. This weekend, my guest is leading musicians not far removed from playing with toys, the newish National Youth Orchestra of China in their U.S. debut, along with pianist Yuzhou Wang. The concert is at Carnegie Hall this Saturday, and I'll give details at the end of our chat. I spoke with Maestro Morlot this past week while he was at Tanglewood in Massachusetts. very happy today to be speaking with Maestro Ludwig Morlot, the music director of the Seattle Symphony. Just a couple months ago in May, I ran a series on Cadenza, a series of maestros who were not born here in the U.S., but were leading major U.S. orchestras. So I had your fellow Frenchman, Louis Langres from Cincinnati, Osmo Venska from Minnesota, Giancarlo Guerrero from Nashville, and from Washington, D.C., Angel Girardonez, the Spanish conductor who does post-classical ensemble. They all have very healthy, beneficial relationships with their orchestras and their cities. You should have been in that lot, but the reason we're talking now, first of all, there's been news and a change with you in Seattle, which we'll get to, but also this weekend, you're going to be working with musicians that we can hear on the East Coast because you're going to be with them at Carnegie Hall this Saturday evening at 8, but we'd have to go even further west from the East Coast past Seattle over the Pacific to find where these musicians come from, and it's the National Youth Orchestra of China. It's their international debut concert. So just to begin, how do you come to lead this group? How do you know this group? How did this all happen?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me on the program. It's exciting, and I always had a very, very kind of not only a connection, but a real aspiration to keep working with younger orchestra. Just because, as I find, as an artist, as a conductor, it's a very humbling experience. You know, you take for granted working with all those great orchestras in your life that you're gonna come on the podium, work on the whatever repertoire, but in this case, Dvorak New World Symphony, and everything is gonna be there pretty much, and then you're gonna put your stamp on it. You know,
right.
Working with young people for me has always been fascinating because it reminds you where you have to start studying the score, you know, and this is really fascinating journey for me all the time. The National Youth Orchestra of China project came through Carnegie Hall, really. I mean, you know, Clive Gillingson was very, very involved from the beginning with this project, but then I was approached to lead this project, which is a little odd because my Chinese is very poor, and I haven't actually been working in that part of the world very much, apart from the occasional touring, you know, stops with some American orchestras. So this has, from the beginning, fascinated me because of the complete new novelty of the project for me, and how much there would be for me to kind of learn out of that experience. And of course, to be able to travel after the concert in Carnegie Hall, to travel to China with all those Chinese musicians, young Chinese musicians, would be a tremendous experience also to visit China from that perspective as well.
Yeah, we should say the Carnegie Hall concert, you have Yuzhi Wang as soloist in the Tchaikovsky concerto. And then when you tour China, you're taking Olga Kern there to be the soloist. The question to you, when Carnegie Hall approached you to do this, and this is certainly a Western bias against China, and China ask it forgive us, but I mean, I'm thinking of China and musicians. I think of the long, long effect of thousands of pianists and a lot of string players. But did you even know that there was a National Youth Orchestra of China before you were approached with this?
No. I mean, that's the first time. This is the inaugural year of the project. And of course, I was approached by Carnegie, but also in connection with Daniela Celota, who is also leading the project.
Yeah.
And I mean, I love the challenge of seeing how all those very skillful musicians can come together and make music by listening to one another, by finding all those different nuances, you know, that they may be not being trained very much in their respectful conservatories as a discipline of music making, you know, the
right.
Chamber music element. And so I've been really always fascinated by how you can make very, very skillful young musicians approach their whole life, actually, of making music differently, and how they might be coming back to their studies in China or wherever that takes them later in their life, and really focus on completely different things, listening, the discipline that one learns by being a section members, for instance, you know, and in an orchestra. And all those things have taken such importance in my life as a musician that I want to share that with them. And obviously we have a great team of teaching artists that are, as we speak, you know, are doing sectionals with the young musicians and really trying to build that understanding and that approach of music making.
Many youth orchestras are full-strength orchestras, but they may number in the 70s, maybe. And being China and just being a bigger country, this is 105 musicians. This is a big sound you're going to get out of these kids.
Yes, it's a big sound, especially because they all individually develop a relatively big sound as well.
And, yeah.
But my challenge, and this is where I think I hope my experience comes strong, is that I want to create the most beautiful pianissimos with that body of strings, for instance. You know, I think the more musicians you have in your orchestra, the more special those soft and quiet dynamic can be. And this is really the journey for us.
Yeah, it's a challenge. From another Seattle Symphony Media recording, this of music he has championed with his orchestra, my guest Ludovic Morlot leads the Seattle Symphony in music of French composer Henri Dutilleux. This, the second movement, Scherzo, from his Symphony No. 1.
Thank you.
when you were their age, you were a violinist. And it took, if I read it right, it took somebody recommending to you, seeing traits you had, seeing some leadership skills you had, to step up on the podium and give it a try. And I'm wondering if you could just sort of relay that story, but also just, it seems to me that that's the right way to find someone to become a conductor. Nowadays, you might have an artist, let's say a pianist, who just wants a change of career, change of perspective, and they think they can go from the keyboard bench up to the podium. Maybe not the best path. I think what happened to you, if you could relay it, is something that works, if you want to put it
that way. Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, I would say it's like any business. When you go up the ladder from the inside, you know, you have a better understanding of what your role might be once you get in the leadership position. So playing in orchestras a lot as a violinist obviously developed my sense of, I mean, first of all, what I would want the conductor to kind of coach me and teach me, but also the things not to do, which is sometimes more important at the end of the day. And but the violin, I think it comes from my love of chamber music, orchestra playing, and coaching, really. I think the conductor's job, or role, I should say, for me is really one of a coach, a music coach, sometimes more, you know, life coach. And I think it's wonderful if, as a conductor, you take that approach of really opening yourself to learn from the musicians as you go. And this is the sense of coaching that I mean, is that you're going to give a lot about what you've experienced, but also always be open to steal anybody's ideas on stage and make it your own, because that's how you grow as an artist.
And not every musician, no matter how talented they are, has those skills. They just must have a different skill set. And I think someone saw in you that those could develop. And so they said, hey, you know, move on up to the front and see what happens, as it were.
Yeah, and the problem is that the minute I started, you know, tasting that life of having an influence on the sound of the orchestra, because I'm also a great lover of architecture and form. And I think I find my path also in studying music through that angle, which is fascinating for me, you know, that thinking of each piece of music as a little building on its own.
So as you start your conducting career, there are some Brits, some English influence in there, but there's a lot of American influence and experience you had on your path to Seattle, the Ozawa Fellowship in Tanglewood, where you're talking to me from now, working with David Robertson in Lyon, and then assistant for the Boston Symphony Orchestra under James Levine. Because you had that experience, how did that kind of shape your view and knowledge of what an American orchestra really was looking for when you decided to take the job in Seattle?
Well, I must say, you know, as a conductor, or as a musician as a whole, I was looking for what would be my personal voice, you know, as an artist. And I always kind of came from that school that, rather than being mentored by one particular teacher, I always felt that I would have a better chance for myself to find my personal voice by being influenced by as many different voices as possible. Mm. And this is why you see such diversity in the mentorship that I chose, you know, from Seiji Ozawa to James Levine to Bernard Haitink, David Robertson, etc. You couldn't name more different musicians, you know. And I felt that this was the path for me, was to really learn from all those wonderful artists and maybe just retain what I felt could connect to my musicianship, my way of making music. And therefore, through that channel, develop my personal voice. And then I guess, you know, this I managed to accomplish in a way where that became appealing for an orchestra to approach me as their music director. But this was the path, really. For me, it was all about finding my personal voice as a musician.
But it did give you insights into how American orchestras have to think and operate, be they union issues, be they just approaches.
Absolutely. I mean, being an assistant at the Boston Symphony for 3 years was the best possible schooling I could dream of. And of course, I had been guest conducting in America quite a bit, but not so different in some sense with any organization those days. I think European orchestras kind of start to have to live with the same model that the American orchestras have been thriving for centuries. But I think this is becoming a pattern where the board meetings, the fundraising, the personal meeting, the artistic advisory committee meetings, all of this is actually part of the things that make that position appealing, because that means you can have some influence in not only drafting your season, but also to connect the people from the community that you want to be connected to your organization with. So it's been a wonderful learning curve to be already as a young man, you know, witnessing this from the outside in Boston, for sure.
Music from Russian composer Vladimir Nikolaev on a Seattle Symphony Media CD that also contains Stravinsky's Firebird Ballet. This work, composed in honor of one of Seattle's greatest musicians and commissioned by one of Seattle's great companies, Boeing. The final minutes from the Sine Wave Land, homage to Jimi Hendrix. The Seattle Symphony is led by their music director and my guest today, Ludovic Morlot. So even after Seattle came a calling and you accepted, you did something then, which a lot of conductors do, and a lot of conductors, especially in that world-class top level, they feel the need, they want to have some experience in the opera house, so you accepted the position in Brussels with one of the leading opera houses, La Monnaie. Now, that didn't last, but I'm just curious, you made that obviously consciously because you thought you needed that experience. Is that why you took that position?
Yeah, I did, and you know, I always believed that a great musician has the ability to play symphonic repertoire, but also opera and chamber music. I mean, a complete musician for me is someone that has the skill to be accompanying, you know, as much as leading a beautiful solo in a symphony. So the Seattle Symphony itself is performing at the opera as well, you know, and La Monnaie was very appealing because he also had this dual role of playing in the pit, but also having a symphonic season at the Beaux-Arts Theater. So I always kind of look for those collaborations where musicians have those opportunities to be complete musicians, in my view, which is really to be able to play all this repertoire in different settings. And then, you know, my adventure in Brussels was wonderful. I mean, 3 years of great music making, great productions. You know, we did, in my time, 4 new productions, which is a big deal. And, you know, the commute was somewhat silly, you know, not one that I wish to anybody from Brussels to Seattle. but yeah, it was a wonderful adventure. And running an opera house is a difficult affair because you deal with not only the union of the orchestra, but another six, you know, at least. And So to be really efficient as a leader for an opera house, I think one has to devote his life to that. And this is very difficult to kind of combine two positions with such a big administrative duties, I would say.
I'm born in Chicago, and I've lived half my life here on the East Coast, New York, you know, Philadelphia. But I had a sister that moved out to the Pacific Northwest decades ago, and I remember first going out to visit her years and years ago and not having ever experienced that area and finding it very different. I'm just wondering what you knew of Seattle and the Pacific Northwest. I mean, yeah, you guest conducted out there, but when you were going to go there and lead the orchestra and live there, what did you know of that area? What your conceptions of and what was close to reality, you know?
I actually knew very little, to be honest. And for me, the gamble was that, I would say the magnet for me was that I could sense this organization was in a route of tremendous development. And I felt like as my first real position, you know, as a music director, this was kind of like a blank slate for me because I could feel that there was so much appetite for innovation and for growth, artistic growth, that I felt this would be a perfect match because we can grow back and forth, bouncing back and forth to each other. Even, you know, being far removed from the rest of the world in some ways, physically, gave me this wonderful opportunity to experience with a lot of different projects. And I always believe that you make a step forward when you've taken two back, right? Or I mean, I should say the other way, right?
The other way, two steps forward, one step back. The other way, you don't get anywhere.
Exactly. I think that was a wonderful opportunity for me to contemplate that pattern, you know, where you innovate a lot and along the way you might fail here and there, but you keep growing exponentially. And I felt the minute I stepped in Seattle that not only the orchestra and the organization had this potential, but the whole city and the whole community was embracing that kind of energy. I mean, you see it with all those different companies that set foot there, right? Amazon, Microsoft, Boeing, Starbucks, you name it. And really this appetite to kind of try things and try to be innovative. And artistically, it's always very rewarding to come in with that attitude.
Well, it's interesting because you stepped in, that orchestra had a period under Jerry Schwartz where they were doing things, especially in the recording world, that other orchestras weren't doing. But you made some really bold steps when you came in. First of all, founding a record label, which other orchestras were doing, but the Seattle Symphony Media, you know, going out and boldly recording things, other American orchestras, I mean, besides the Due to You, but, you know, even just doing Ives and American music, Ravel, Stravinsky, and then winning Grammy Awards upon that. And then one of those recordings from a composer who really wasn't that well known, John Luther Adams, and then that becoming the Pulitzer Prize winner for 2014. That was all pretty heady stuff. I mean, I don't know if you could have planned that type of success.
So well, it goes alongside, you know, I would say it goes alongside what I said as defining yourself as an artist and finding your personal voice. And I think I did the same thing with the orchestra. I felt like the commission to John Luther Adams was for me important because he was an American composer that, you know, lived in Alaska at the time and really kind of embraced that understanding of what that region was offering in terms of the sonic landscapes. And I felt if any orchestra should appropriate that voice for itself, that is the Seattle Symphony. And, you know, I couldn't plan the success and the repercussion of that commission. But the same with Ives and Luthier and even creating our own label was to really have that freedom to program our recordings with complete liberty and complete control on what I thought or I believed that the voice of the orchestra should be. And yeah, this has been an amazingly rewarding journey that continues, you know. I mean, we are still very active with recording some more of those composers, and this has been quite a tremendous experience.
My guest, Ludovic Morlot, has recorded American music on the Seattle Symphony Media label. From a disc with Gershwin's American in Paris, Elliot Carter's Instances, here are the final minutes from the second movement of Charles Ives' Symphony No. 2.
Thank you.
Another thing you've done out there, maybe some of our East Coast people don't even know that, is you've initiated a lot of things to get new ears, new people, restructuring the format of concerts, the times of concerts, the attitude towards concerts. If you just name a couple of those initiatives, because I know other orchestras do them, but Seattle is a city that will embrace things like that, like you've talked about. So just talk about some of the initiatives you've had that really been quite successful or eye-opening to you.
Yeah, there are quite a few, and they're indeed being practiced in other places. But, you know, because none of those are my ideas. It's just that things that I've witnessed somewhere that triggered something in me. And that's so late night, for instance, late night in the lobby, instead of having the very formal concert presentation in the hall, we do a 10 p.m. on Friday called Untitled, which presents mostly chamber contemporary music in a very informal setting, just like the rock concerts in New York, you know, when Boulez was there. So people can sit on the floor, on carpets or sofas, you know, with a glass of wine and listen to very challenging repertoire. And this has been tremendous in bringing new audiences. And, you know, I'm being careful not to say younger audiences.
Right.
Because it's not necessarily the case. It's really some people with completely different interests. We do also another series on Friday early without an intermission, short concert, an hour concert that we call Untux, where the orchestra plays in their everyday clothes, you know. So something, again, that breaks this cliche that you have to dress up to go to the concert, or you have to be knowledgeable about what's going to be played, you know. I think there's also room for stepping out of the office, catching an hour of music, and then go out with your friends, you know, like you had planned to. I think this goes also with repertoire, of course. You know, we created another series called Sonic Evolution, where we collaborate with musicians from Seattle, all genres, mixed genres, you know, you name it, hip-hop, yeah, rock and roll. So, you know, some members of Pearl Jam have participated in that, also some mix a lot. You might have heard about this experience we had and collaboration. So for me, it's just like we can't complain of having a very narrow audience if we offer a very narrow product, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think the real power of symphonic music is the impact that it has sound-wise more than repertoire-wise. I always say the story that, you know, when I was a kid and I went to my first concert with a family member, I couldn't tell you even to this day what music was being played. But I remember the experience of walking into the concert hall and experiencing symphonic music.
Mm-hmm.
So this is based on my experience as a kid. I want to be creating this for everybody in our community, and that, you know, you're invited to experience live symphonic music regardless of your taste when it comes to music. And maybe that impact and that memory, building on that first memory, will make it more comfortable for you to want to come back and experience that again. And you only get to love it when you experience it again and again and again. Like new repertoire, you only start to loving a new piece of music because you get a chance to hear it again and love more things in it. So I want to be able to create that first memory, anybody in the community. And it has worked. I mean, we've been successful in 6 years growing the concert attendance by 10 points. I mean, or even more, which is a tremendous reward when you build all those different things.
That's an interesting analogy you give to the being a young child and not remembering the concert, remembering the experience of walking into the hall, which, excuse the very American analogy, but it's like, I would assume if you talk to any kid, like if they go to their first Major League Baseball game as a kid, they don't remember the game, they don't remember the outcome, but they remember walking into the stadium. And
and you're right making that comparison, because I think this is what it is. You know, you deal with emotions, adrenaline,
right,
and this is what music in the first place is being established for.
And the third area, again, other orchestras are doing this, but you in Seattle have been so successful with some of the educational outreach and working with young kids and the number of kids you reach in the Seattle area. I want to commend you. It's really heartening.
Thank
to
you.
See that really works well. And again, that's just, then you do have to talk about young listeners, because you're sort of planting the seeds there, and these kids will grow up to see music as music and just enjoy it however they
and
wish
yet,
to.
And yet, I mean, I take your compliment, but yet I'm very disappointed that we cannot do more.
Yeah.
Because, you know, this is only 90 some musicians in my orchestra and so many services that we can devote to that particular field. But I feel that I'm investing now a lot of time and energy thinking about this. But I was recently in Berlin and got really inspired by the idea of digital concert hall, but as an educational tool, that I really believe there's a future for that. If all the schools will be willing to actually devote 20 minutes a week, you know, remove 20 minutes a week from the regular curriculum and just stream live a little connection with their local symphony and build that kind of ongoing relationship weekly with the conductor, with the musicians, with music itself, with a little performance, a little rehearsal time, where we can really create that relationship, I think the world can change for us. Because, again, those kids will have the memory of creating that relationship and will want to go to the concert hall and experience it live. There's a lot of things that we haven't explored or agreed with the schools yet how to make it work. But I think there's a real tool here with technology that we, especially in a place like Seattle, you know, there's so much that we can explore with and expand our work into this field of education within our communities. And I think this is precious, because it's not only to build our audiences, but it's because I just think the world will be better with music all around, you know.
Yeah, I agree. The technology's there. The will has to follow it. The vision has to follow it. And I mean, there's so much research of what music and the arts can do for young minds. And I agree. I'm as frustrated as you, but you know.
And it's hard to put kids in a bus, you know. I mean, this is a lot of effort. As much as I love to see them come in once in a while, and we do the Link Up program with that Carnegie launched as well. We do a lot of those programs that brings a lot of kids into the hall and also have them play music alongside the symphony, which I think is also very wonderful.
Right.
But it's still a very small token of what we should be invested into, I think.
Recorded on the Cantaloupe label is a work commissioned by the Seattle Symphony and their music director, and my guest today, Ludovic Morlot, from American composer John Luther Adams, the 45-plus minute work, which is called Become Ocean, and it won the 2014 Pulitzer Prize for Music. Here are the final minutes from that recording. So as our listeners have heard, a lot of great things happening in Seattle. Your contract was extended to 2019, and then you informed them, I believe, in April that that would be the time that you would step away from Seattle. You're going to look at New Horizons. You haven't been specific as to what those are. So just two questions off of that decision. Personally, just knowing your timeline, time to move on, maybe just to talk about that end of it, just not where you're going, but what you're going to do, but just the feeling of moving on. And then sort of dovetail into, are there times where maestros have to move on from orchestras and opera houses and such, and those in leadership? I mean, we're not in the Ormandy era anymore of, you know, decades and decades. So is it because of the way things are structured better for a group and an individual to go and seek new challenges? I mean, talk about it personally and then in a bigger view of just what...
Yeah, well, I think it is very personal indeed. And I feel that from day one that I stepped in Seattle, I made it no secret that I want to nurture that relationship like I nurture the birth and death of a music note, you know?
Right.
That the note born from silence has, we deal with the attack of the note very carefully, with the sustain of the note very carefully, and too often we don't think about how we release that note.
Mm-hmm.
And from day one, I really thought of that journey that I would have in Seattle in those terms, is that I wanted to, you know, squeeze that lemon as much as my ability and energy would provide, and really be able to plan ahead enough so that I can live it in a way where the next step will happen being already stronger, you know, with whoever they chose to be. And I always felt that, especially as a young artist, because, you know, I'm only in my early 40s, and
right. This
is my first position as a music director, there's as much as I can imagine having this orchestra grow under my leadership. And I feel that the next step in my life or the next chapter in my life might be already very different because I would have built on those 8 years of experience with that leadership role. So I just felt that it's not only for my own development, but it's also because I love the Seattle Symphony so much, and what I've done with those musicians is so special that I want to give them that opportunity to not run out of breath, but just be able to kind of embark right on the heels of that relationship to something even more exciting and even more challenging. And I hope I can be the one providing this somewhere else. And, you know, this is something very important to me. And because I think that speaks volume for what kind of musicians I want to be. You know, it's not about me. It's about the music that we can create together. And this is the most important thing for me. In general terms, I think the Ormandy years are not gone, actually. I think it just becomes more and more pertinent to be staying longer at the helm of an orchestra as you grow older, because not only of your experience, but your wealth of repertoire. I mean, as a young artist, everything you do is the first or second time, right?
Right.
When you come to do a Mahler symphony for the 20th time, then there's real purpose to just be staying 20 years with that organization.
Mm.
And it goes alongside the whole of the, you know, music making, but also everything that goes with leading an organization.
I know the news probably shocked a lot of people in Seattle, but you've been very forthright, and we look forward to wherever your new horizon takes you, and have a great time this weekend with these 105 Chinese musicians. I close all my cadenza interviews by asking all my guests the same two questions. And the first question is a hypothetical, which says, if you could chat like we've been chatting with someone from the past, someone you never could have a chance to chat with but could talk with. When I ask that question, what's the first name that pops into your head of someone you'd love to talk with?
Well, that's so difficult.
If you think about it, you get swamped with names. So
yeah, I mean, staying in the conductor's field and musician, I would say Pierre Monteux.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm not too sure why I'm saying this, and I guess because I started conducting at the Monteux School, and I always felt a very strong connection to that conductor and that man, that people. Man, and you know, maybe if another Frenchman that had much success in America with his life, and maybe that's why.
Yeah. Well, and he's also, I mean, he was on the podium for a lot of crucial moments in music in the 20th century, you know?
Exactly.
It's funny with conductors over the years, cadenza's been on over a decade. Bach is the number one runaway answer, but with conductors, it's Mahler usually. So you're the first one to pick Monteux, by the way, but it's also very interesting that you would pick him.
Oh, no, Mahler would have frightened me like hell. Well, you know, I could say composers too, because, you know, the more I think about it, the more I would just go into wanting to sit with Ravel and Stravinsky, and of course, but, you know, just out of my mind, speaking of a mentor that I've never had a chance to meet somewhat.
Well, I'm excited that you brought Dutilleux to Seattle, and I hear you're also going to do quite a bit of Messiaen before you leave, so I'm looking forward to that as well. Mm-hmm. The final question's a non-musical question, meaning everybody I interview on Cadenza fills their life with music. Maestros at your level are extremely busy. But when you have to pull yourself away from music, pleasure, relaxation, enjoyment, a little respite from music, what do you do that can pull yourself away when you need to get away?
Well, I mean, the first thing is family, because of, you know, I don't get to see my daughters as much as I'd like to, and my wife. So this is, family is number one, of course. But just for myself, just to let go, I play tennis quite a bit. So sport, I would say sport is the way for me to really switch off. And yet it's very similar to what I do daily, because you need that discipline, that adrenaline to it. And so I find there's a lot of things that I learn from exercising and performing on the tennis court that I can bring to my musicianship as well.
Well, again, wherever you end up and however long that takes, we wish you the best of success with that. And thanks for taking some moments with us.
Well, thank you so very much.
Maestro Ludovic Morlot, music director of the Seattle Symphony. You can find out more about my guest at his website, Ludovic, L-U-D-O-V-I-C, Morlot, M-O-R-L-O-T.com. You can check out what he is doing with the Seattle Symphony at seattlesymphony.org, and that is also where you can find the recordings made on their very successful Seattle Symphony Media label. The label is also distributed by Naxos, and you can check them out at naxos.com. He is expanding into the music of Olivier Messiaen, and the new recording of works by that great French 20th century composer is due out in the next few weeks. My guest will be leading the newish National Youth Orchestra of China in their U.S. debut this Saturday evening at 8 at Carnegie Hall in New York City. Also on the program is special guest pianist Yuzhou Wang, a soloist in the Piano Concerto No. 1 of Tchaikovsky, and my guest will lead the orchestra and music of Zhao Long and the New World Symphony of Dvorak. Tickets and information available at CarnegieHall.org. Since my guest will be leaving his Seattle Symphony in a couple years, and both he and the orchestra will be starting in new directions, I leave you with an overture. Music of Gabriel Fauré, the overture from his Masques et Bergamasques. The Seattle Symphony is led by their current music director and my guest today, Ludovic Morlot. And as always, I'm glad you're in the audience today, and I hope you'll join me here each week for a chat with the great classical musicians of our area and the globe. Remember, you can catch any recent past Cadenza program by going to wwfm.org and clicking on Classical and then Webcasts. I ask you to please support this and the many specialty programs we offer by making your donation today at our website. Thank you, and thanks for listening. I'm David Ozenberg, and this has been the award-winning Cadenza, an exclusive production of the Classical Network and WWFM.org.